How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
This message comes from our sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TeladocHealth/whatsyourwhy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
So today we're having an incredible discussion on the topic, should Ghana look east or west? So that's the question we're asking. And we've empaneled some of the fantastic brains we have in this country. And they will join you, who is listening on radio, to help us discuss and to look at whether or not Ghana should look east or west. So the show is being hosted by Kojo Nyankson and MFA Apao. And on the guest tonight, we have Professor H. Kwesi Prempeh. He is with the Center for Democratic Development, CDD. Dr. Yao Graham of the Third World Network. Mavis Owusu-Jemfi is with the Africa Center for Economic Transformation. We have Yao Nsaku, who is with the an amalgam of professional bodies. And Dr. Prisla Chumesi-Bafo, Department of Economics, University of Ghana. And also, we have Bright Simons of the Imani Africa. You might want to join us and stay with us from now till 9 p.m. when we explore the issue of whether Ghana should turn east or west. Let's join them now.
Whoever comes on board to serve the interest of the country is what we should pursue. So we should pursue an agenda where we are dealing with a diversified group of people, countries that are helping us work towards the agenda of growth and development that we desire. And that kind of desire is a sustainable one, not a random what kind of growth that we tend to find because of overall our resource dependence nature of our economy, the import dependent nature of our economy. So when you cast your mind back to, for example, our relationship with the West over the period, you would see that pivotal in that relationship, I must say, would be in the early 80s, where Ghana and a number of other developing countries embarked on the era of structural adjustment, economic recovery programs. And based on that, you find that a lot of policy prescriptions that came at the time, in addition to the resources that came to sort out the economic challenges, were based on basically the Washington Consensus. Mm. And over time, we have realized that a number of the policy prescriptions that were given to the country could not really fit based on the peculiar nature of the challenges that we face. And so for that matter, the overemphasis on neoliberalism ideals, free market economy, privatization, liberalize and let the private sector take the center stage. In not too distant future, we have observed that, for example, the successes or the miracles of the newly industrialized economies means that it is not the one-size-fits-all ideal. You need to come out with a strategy that works for each peculiar circumstance, because a lot of the policy prescriptions took it for granted that the institutions that existed in the developed world also existed in the developing world. Mm. But we face certain challenges that could not make those policy prescriptions translate. Mm. And so for that matter, and when you look at some of the corporations and the conditionalities we have had with the West, you see that there's a lot of emphasis on democracy, institutional reforms and all that. More like a precursor for development. And other countries such as Singapore, Thailand, and all that have shown us that really democracy can be a significant necessary factor for development, but it is not really enough. You need a number of things. We need resources, we need investment, and that is what we lack. For that reason, when you look at recent times, China is offering that, Russia is offering that. Mm. And when you look at the strategy, is basically they are telling you that resources are available for economic cooperation. China is emphasizing on a south-south win-win cooperation, not like a master servant dictating issues to you. And so they are emphasizing more on sovereignty and your free will to do things. But then that is also coming with a lot of suspicion from the West with regards to issues of how African countries finance and all that. And so I would say that Ghana should pursue an agenda with Ghana's interest being paramount. Mm. And anyone who comes on board with a strategy to help us move to the end that we are seeking, it's welcome.
Now, before I bring in Yao Nsakwo, who joins us via Zoom, let's see if we can sort of situate the strategies, the individual strategies of the various blocs that make up the East and the West. So we find that Europe and America tend to have a similar strategy. They want to use debt and aid as their sort of carrot and stick to gain control of resources in Africa. Then you have China that offers infrastructure and credit. Then you've got Russia that comes with this very interesting new approach of military as foreign policy. So they will give you military assistance, and in exchange, they'll take a few of your resources. Now, some see the West as the devil, you know. We've been associated with them for such a long time. We kind of know how they operate. We know what they want, and we know what they offer. It seems a safe space. The Eastern push is new. Like you said, it's faced with a bit of suspicion. So in your assessment, looking at what Ghana's unique situation is, do we play it safe, or do we dare to look east?
I think we should not play it safe, but we should be cautious in engaging with the East. Why do I say so? The reason why there's a bit of suspicion with Eastern Corporation, it's how liberal it appears to be without conditionalities. And we know that there is no free lunch, essentially. And so, and the reason also is that even within the West Corporation that we have had over the years, with stringent requirements of transparency, anti-corruption, and all that, we still find ourselves where we are. And so in that regard, getting resources and engaging with the East without a lot asked with regards to issues of governance, transparency, corruption issues, and all that. And indeed, when you look at the strategy China has adopted, it's basically infrastructure development in Africa. We know there is a big infrastructure gap, and that is the reason why there is a high cost of doing business on the continent. Africa is fragmented. We are just too pocket-sized in terms of the economies. We agree that there is the need for regional integration. Regional integration requires infrastructure. We do not have the needed resources to make up for that infrastructure. And so cooperation is required. But it is even estimated that with all the infrastructural development that China is investing in on the continent, it is still not enough. But even said, with all this, we realize that infrastructural investment is also an avenue for corruption on the continent. And so you find that there is usually white elephant projects. There are projects without enough allowances for maintenance, and so for which reason projects are overvalued, and that means that their returns are not adequate to pay for themselves over the period. And so getting some resources somewhere without a lot asked as to what the conditions are and all, if we are not careful and we do business as usual without a lot of transparency, I'm afraid a lot of African countries, including Ghana, would find ourselves in deep debts.
I want to bring in Yao Nsakho. Now, Yao Nsakho, of course, has been a major part of all of our thought leadership events here on Joy News. Yao, it's a pleasure to have you this evening. Good evening.
Good evening. Hello, Islam, my good friend.
Now, this finally, we're having this this discussion. It's been a long time coming. But as we start to shape the conversation, something has become glaringly obvious. First of all, maybe I should state, this is really not a binary conversation. It's not just East and West. There are other players. There's the Middle East. There's the novel strategies of the blue economy coming from the South. There's a lot. But the glaring omission is the clearly stated desire of Ghana. What does Ghana want? Where do we, how do we go about starting to answer that question?
Yeah, you remember that when we started to speak about this, I said that I hoped that it was not going to be a panel that all agreed, because the theme was such that I could not see that there would be much disagreement. And I was just listening to Priscilla, and I was saying, well, okay, maybe all the other people... Do I still have you?
Yes, we're here.
All the other people will more or less say the same. Since we're going to be on for some time, let me just start by saying, for me, the formulation of what Ghana must do must begin by us saying, whether we look east or west, why are we looking in the first place? We have tended to normalize certain definitions of development, which in my view give the impression that so long as the elite more or less are doing well, the lucky 10%, as they call them, then we are developing. And then we have all these financial indices that we attach, and we say we're growing X percent, Y percent, and we're happy. But for me, the starting point of the development discourse is, how do we lift the majority of our compatriots into dignity? That really is the key thing. If we set that as the true north, then the rest of the question resolves itself. We know where we are going. The only way that I'll formulate it slightly differently is that we should not wait for people to say this is what they offer. We must, knowing the contour lines in which the world is shaped, we must approach people and say, this is what we bring, this is what we think that you can bring. We try to look for win-win constructs and we move on. That's how I would look at it.
That's a very succinct summary of how we ought to approach it. Thanks for that. And of course, Yao Nsakwe is with us for the duration. We'll be hearing more from him. I want to bring in Dr. Yao Graham. Now, he's the coordinator of Third World Network Ghana, Third World Network Africa. Thank you. Forgive me for diminishing your geographical coverage, but it's very nice to have you. Thank you very much for making the time. So now this big existential question, East or West, and we've already kind of set everybody into their roles. The West seems to be the devil, you know, with their loans and aid and very clear conditionalities. Then we have the East that seems to suggest that, well, do what you like with the money, just make sure you pay back, otherwise you owe us a harbor. That tends to be the sort of Belt and Road strategy we hear from China. Then we have Russia with this brand new idea that, we'll send you some mercenaries and give us some diamonds in exchange or gold or whatever it is in that mine, you have in your country. Now, if what we want is development, are there some very clear directions in which we ought to immediately embark? And what, as a voter going into an election, what should we expect to hear potential leaders say about that direction?
Yeah, thanks very much and good evening to your listeners and viewers. I think Yao Nsakwe made an important point, which is about basically framing the question around whose vision of development, whose Ghana are we talking about? This is important because depending on whose Ghana you're talking about, even if what the point he makes about, that you need, and also Priscilla made, that you need to look for a diversity of sources, the permutation of the things that you look for, the permutation of the relationships that you form will differ. Let me give you a historical example to illustrate the point. After Nkrumah was overthrown, the new NLC stroke Progress Party, NLC was a military regime, which put the Progress Party in power. Yeah. The new NLC stroke Progress Party regime was very keen to be seen as an ally of the West. So they broke with what was the African consensus and started talking about dialogue with South Africa and sent the foreign minister to South Africa at a period when apartheid was at its most brutal, not long after the Sharpeville massacre.
Yeah.
Now, they defined Ghana's interest at that time essentially as starting from a presumption of a strategic anchor with the West. That's how they interpreted their notion of Ghana as a market economy, Ghana as a democracy. Of course, Ghana was ridiculed. Mm. Ghana became a joke. And it took a very long time to position ourselves back in the committee.
This message comes from our sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy and Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
To African nations. Why is this example important? Because at that time, decolonization was a point of consensus for the continent. Decolonization was important because African countries believed in regional integration. For regional integration to work, it was recognized that that southern cone of the country, which was dominated by settler colonialism, was incompatible with a notion of a free Africa integrated and building itself. So maybe they didn't share this vision of an integrated Africa. They saw their relationship with the West as primary. So they were ready to jump through the hoops of a relationship of apartheid South Africa and be isolated in Africa. There are consequences that flow from that in terms of your relations. So whose interest is extremely important. So if you take that, I think there are a number of elements that Priscilla spoke about which I would like to add. I mean, even the notion of regional integration. Whose definition of regional integration? Now, there are many elements in regional integration that we can all agree on. The African Continental Free Trade Agreement is being negotiated at the moment. A lot of people see it as an expression of Pan-Africanism. But at the same time, a lot of ordinary people are saying, we want a borderless Africa where we can cross borders and go around the continent. The AfCFTA is about free movement of capital, free movement of goods, okay? And also, say, services. Now, of course, that is important for the continent. But people feel that the borderless, the ordinary people can go and come is not being taken account of. Now, I'm raising this so that, I mean, if you're a big company looking to move your goods to country X in Africa and access that market, it's great. If you are a tourist, an African tourist who wants to go to another African country, you may find it difficult because the free movement is not there. Now, so that at the end of the day, therefore, what a government conceives to be the national interest is based on what ultimately sees as the best equilibrium of contending interests in a society that then packages its foreign relations. And foreign relations here is not simply around politics, but also around the economic questions, you know, that she was talking about and the sources of investment. So if you took it that way, then of course the national interest is defined in a particular way. And to take your East-West thing, now, when the United States saw the Soviet Union as this great strategic rival and was aware that there was a split between the then two big communist powers, China and the Soviet Union, they saw an opportunity to drive a wedge and isolate the Soviet Union. They were against communism, but the United States facilitated the admission of China into the United Nations to displace Taiwan, who up to now they continue to arm. The United States saw the possibility of a big market in China. The United States supported the admission of China to the World Trade Organization, which allowed China to have access to markets around the world. China joined the WTO, China joined the IMF, China became the biggest lender to the United States. China, the biggest manufacturing platform for the United States, even as the United States saw it as a strategic rival in Asia. I'm just giving you this complexity. So we need to see the complexity that ought to go into this. So if you take West Africa now, where we have a regional security problem with, you know, armed insurgencies and so on, we need to be interested in a common regional approach. What does that mean for how we relate with our neighbors? At the moment, our relations with the Sahelian countries are strained. So I'm just throwing this out. I don't give a direct answer, but to offer a view that depending on what you see as a national interest, you construct your economic and political and security relations in a certain way. So the present government, taking a view of how to deal with the terrorism issue in the region, clearly feels that relations with the United States and NATO is priority. So our president went and sat in front of Blinken and basically snitched on Burkina Faso. And he felt that was very important. They are next door to us. Even if you disagree with them, how do you manage it? For me, really, this for me, these are foundational to a definition of, you know, how we build relations. So if China is lending to the United States and it's a source of investment and manufactures, if it's good for the biggest power in the world, should we be basically following the United States to say China is a threat to the world? They may be in competition for dominance in the world, but we are a small country looking for capital, looking for markets, looking for technology. How do we play that business? That is a moment definitely not to look east or west. At any moment, therefore, that complexity should guide the how you permute in your relationships and sources of resources.
Thanks for that. Now, just before we come back into the studio, Yao, I wonder, I have to satisfy my curiosity. You were hoping to hear views that you wouldn't necessarily agree with. Have you heard any yet, or are we still all in alignment?
But maybe as we discuss into deeper detail some of the cleavages in points of view. But I just listened to what Dr. Yao Graham was saying. I'm sure he's wondering why I'm calling him with his title. But since there are two Yaos, we're going to have to distinguish one way or the other. And I agree with everything that he said. The only element that I'll keep stressing mind exactly what we're trying to integrate, and I think that's what y'all was touching on. Are we trying to integrate states, or are we trying to integrate people? So when we talk about continental free trade agreement, is it an integration of the African people, or is it an integration of the African states? And if it's an integration of the African states, what is the character of those states? In my view, those states have never been sufficiently or comprehensively decolonized. They have kept the character of being captured by the elite. And so if it's an integration of states, then what tends to happen is that it's an integration of elite interests. They are similar class interests. They facilitate the movement of their fund flows to benefit them. And we say that we are making progress with all of these things, but you look at the mass of our compatriots and things are not moving. Let's look at a few indices. The World Food Program recently said 1 billion Africans are undernourished. In spite of all the noise and celebration and hoo-ha about Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement, we still have 3% of GDP. Nigeria, which is sitting right next to us, according to the trade resilience report that the Ghana Statistical Service, this is not my data, Ghana Statistical Service has brought up, 2.5% of our exports go to Nigeria. If you look at our own exports in Ghana, it's 20% to Africa. So a key part of this is that the rhetoric seems right. The reality is very far away. And in my view, as I have tried to study and understand this, a huge part of why you see this significant decoupling is that the discussion about governance in Africa, the discussion therefore of foreign policy orientation, what y'all was just talking about Akufo-Addo going to sit before blinking, have completely left behind the people themselves. I doubt very much that if we had a process of arriving at some sort of consensus on how we should treat relationships with Burkina Faso, the people of Ghana, and when I say the people, I don't mean only the elites, I mean all the people, would have said that the way to resolve a problem with a country that we have a history of fraternal relations with is to fly somewhere and go and report them. So for me, looking east or west is not really what the issue. What is at the storm center, the epicenter of what we are trying to do? The epicenter has to be that we are trying to secure the long-term health of our society, and particularly the mass of our population that for 67 years, 70 years, whatever it is, have been left behind. We are configuring things so that whatever the outcome becomes, we are able to look back and say, at this point we started, now we can see that they have gone significantly up. In that construct, I think y'all touched on it as well, East and West become a little bit irrelevant. There was a certain construct of geopolitics in which East and West, post-1945 world, Cold War, etc., it meant a lot. Today, when you say East and West, what exactly do you mean? Is Japan part of the West or is it part of the East? Not totally clear. Geographically, it belongs somewhere. There are those who think that the Bandung spirit, as Sami Amin used to call it, looking at it from a point of view of the global South and the global North, is much more important because all of us are rising up against certain specific hegemonic powers. The markets are already, they are not empty. And if you're going to try to go at it as Ghana, Gambia, and so on and so forth, you don't stand a chance. So you need to come together. But in doing that, there are several elements that are playing around. What sort of systems should we borrow? We have, for example, without necessarily acknowledging that that is the situation, because of our colonial history and so on, our default position, we tend to know a lot about what the former colonialists are doing, but what other people are doing. When you ask many Ghanaian intellectuals about the details of what is going on in Asia, for example, they're a little bit lost. Latin America, they are lost. That spirit of consensus that in 1955 led in 66, Tricontinental in Havana, got people together to think about how you can lift the countries that had been left behind, the periphery, if you want to call it that. That seems to be broken. And for me, that is the real conversation that we need to tackle in the development and in the foreign policy discourse. I think East or West, we can settle it in 10 minutes. You go around, everybody will tell you it's going to have to be a mixture. It's going to have to be a delicate balance of whose priorities are we really championing and which realities are we facing.
Mm. Well, I certainly am interested in the detail of it because, if it's going to be a mixture, what do we do with the East? What do we do with the West? What do we do with Russia? What do we do with China? What do we do with Europe and the U.S.? What specifically, what sort of specific deals do we strike with each of them? Now, Professor H. Kwesi Prempeh, of course, has been Executive Director of CDD Ghana for a number of years now. It's great to have you, Prof. Indeed. So while all of this is going on, it occurs to me that this is the first time that we've introduced this as an election conversation. Why is that the case? It seems to me such a fundamental question. What do we want and who do we want it from? Why have we not demanded these answers from those who wish to govern us?
Well, I think probably part of the answer to your question is that to be able to answer the framing or this binary framing, I think around the table, as I was driving in, I paid some attention to what Priscilla and Yao and Yao have been saying. I think around the table, there's clearly an emerging consensus that rejects this binary framing of the issue, East or West, for a number of the reasons that both Yao's have enumerated. But I think the question also presupposes a certain agency on our part, right? I mean, to be able to look East or West, South or North, Northeast or Southeast, assume that you are in a position of exercising some agency. And maybe if your observation is correct, maybe the reason we're in this, we're trying to inject this kind of question into the election debate is that we know we are in a place where agency is not something we can take for granted, right? We have huge constraints on our ability to make choices for reasons that, you know, some would say our own doing, for some reasons of international geopolitics, political economy, and all of those things. But I think that we are in a place now where, unfortunately, our options appear quite limited. And so, really, when your options are that limited, you also find yourself in a place where you may not be able to make the wisest bargains for yourself, because really you've put yourself in a bind and you are not able to make the best choices for your country. So there's a sense, I think, that there's a certain concern, you know, not only in Ghana, but across Africa, you know, that people are signing away their birthrights, you know, that we're, you know, for a mess of pottage, we are willing to make Esau-like decisions.
Yeah.
You know, in a world where the Jacobs are all over the place and are trying to play us one against the other. So I think that the emergence of this as an election year issue may not necessarily be surprising because of where we are and a certain recognition that, you know, our agency is severely constrained. Mm-hmm. You know, but I also like, I think I just want to really just follow on some of the points that have been made. Yeah, that of course, if you frame the question this way, East or West, I mean, Yao makes the important point that our historical default, just by virtue of where we're coming from, colonialism and all of that, is of course the West,
yeah.
Right? But even that, you know, what are we looking to the West or to the East for? You know, for me, it's an important question. What exactly are we looking? Is this about looking one direction or the other for models, political models, economic models? Are we looking for inspiration? Are we looking for capital, for technology, for ideas? You know, and I think depending on what it is that we are looking for, you would find that, you know, the options are not necessarily that binary. I think Yao made an important point, Yao Graham, that is, made an important point of, you know, taking us through some of the evolution in the relationship between the US and China. Mm. I mean, so the US itself has looked east before, mm-hmm. right? When it suited its strategic interest at the point, and these things are fluid, right? So at a certain point in its historical, in the evolution of its foreign policy and relations in the world, it looked, you know, to make friends with China, drive a wedge between all of those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And today we are in a different place. The US is in a different place when it comes to China. And China has also looked west before. Right, not just for ideas, you know, for a number of things, right? So even the opening, you know, at a time when we in Africa were probably making a lot of noises about multinational companies, you know, China was at, you know, switched gears, and then said, well, you know, some of you just come in here and do business here. Mm. You know, China, we talk about globalization, but China is one of the biggest beneficiaries of, you know, this whole globalization story about, you know, WTO and the like. So both sides, if we take them, China and the US, as representing the polar opposites and representing both sides, they've looked, you know, in their respective, in the opposite direction for inspiration, for capital, for alliances and the like, when it suited their interest. And I think that, of course, the intelligent position would be to say that, yes, to the extent that we too are a nation state and have our own interests and our priorities, we ought to be able to make those kind of a la carte choices, you know, depending on what it is that our interests are. You know, but the agency question is important, because when you don't have a lot of agency, then that's when, you know, this issue becomes a tough one. You know, so, you know, I think that we are all saying the same thing, essentially, right? But it starts with a definition of what it is that your interests are as a country. And it's also important that this is not a monolithic thing. Within the country itself, there are different competing interests. You know, whose interests predominate? Whose interests define the national interest? Is it the particular clique that happens to be in power for the time being? Is it the interest of the mass of the population? And I think, for me, one way I see this is that, you know, from the dawn of independence, our fundamental interests have not changed, right? So what was it about? It was first about sovereignty, right? Seek ye first the political kingdom. Nkrumah meant by that, you know, free yourself, you know, from foreign domination. And then other things will be added. You know, the other things were development, you know. They defined them in terms of freedom. Freedom from hunger, from want, from poverty, from illness and disease. So all of these freedoms, you know, when you express them in another form, was really development, what we call development. So seek first sovereignty, political, economic, and then, you know, you work on the issues of development. And I think fundamentally, those interests have stayed steady. I don't think anybody will tell you those are not our interests, right? Those interests have stayed steady, maybe with some nuance, maybe sustainable development has now been added onto it, because we now have to think about intergenerational development and sustainability of the methods that we're using. Those have held steady. What has changed, I think, and what has also presented this question of choices between East or West, is that at some point, we started off making certain choices at independence, right? And they were not choices about development or whether or not, but about methods. How do you get to the destination? Development is your goal. You want food security, you want social cohesion, you want to be free of conflict, you want you know, education, a well-trained population, you want all of those things. I think in the early years, their choice then, which was also not inconsistent with what was happening globally, was in favor of, you know, very heavy state-centered approaches with implications for the political choices we also made. So we basically almost made a bargain, you know, for suspend democracy and human rights and all of those things, and we'll give you development. And I think we ran that bargain. That bargain ran its course somewhat for 30 years. And then when the harvest that we got, both politically and economically, did not seem, you know, we're not content with it. It had taken us into, depending on the country, you know, conflicts, you know, economic collapse, failed states, especially in our region. Then also, I think the primary model at the time, you know, the Soviet, then also came collapsing around the same time. So then you had this rethinking. Okay, so we've carried on with this model for some time. It's not worked. Whether or not we carried on with it with any fidelity, it's another question. But we chose non-democratic or authoritarian projects as the means of delivering development. They did not work for 30 years. So we switched. We said, oh, democratization. And then it came along with also market, you know, neoliberal market economics around the same time, roughly the same time. So we switched. That has run another 30 years, right? So I think the time is just about right. We've had this 30 years, and a 30-year hitch has come, so maybe let's reassess where we are, how we're doing with this other approach to the business. But I think our fundamental interests, I would not say, have changed. You know, now we are at a point where we are assessing, you know, which of the approaches to development would appear to work in our context.
Yes. Prof, if indeed you're right that step one is to seek sovereignty and freedom from all of these ills, poverty and disease and so forth, if that's step one, does that not perhaps
fuel the argument that we should be moving away from the West? Because historically, they tend to come along with conditionalities that attack sovereignty. We're currently in the middle of this massive confusion around this LGBTQ bill that Ghana insists on passing, that the United States, you know, is signaling their displeasure with. And the threat is there, you know, we'll take away your aid, we'll take away your loans, we'll you know. Sovereignty seems to be the first thing you lose when you go west, isn't it?
Well, I'm not too sure that, I mean, again, sovereignty in whose interest, what kind of sovereignty, right? So sovereignty also, in its contemporary understanding, also includes on the part of state parties a responsibility to protect, right? So the fact that you can mount sovereignty when you're actually butchering your people to death, right? And some non-state actors, some external power says, oh, but you cannot do that. You say, oh, but I'm sovereign. I'm free to just butcher my citizens to death, right? I mean, I don't think that that's the sense in which, you know, we should understand the term sovereignty. We are not, I mean, citizens are not basically slaves of the state, that whoever happens for the time being to manage the country can then use sovereignty as a shield to do to their citizens whatever it is that they want. I don't think that's the understanding of sovereignty. You know, but it's also, even the choice, even the things you mentioned, you know, LGBT and all of those kinds of things. I mean, you have also to ask, you know, what, you know, how much agency even do we have in those choices? Right? Maybe the United States is protesting the bill, but do we also know what other external interests are behind even shopping those bills around? Why are they all of a sudden in currency in Africa? You go to, are they really the primary concerns of African citizens and governments? And this is where we are, that of all the things we face, Uganda, Kenya, you know, Malawi, you know, Senegal, Ghana, these things are making the rounds, roughly the same template. You know, is that really what, are we being diverted? Has our attention being diverted in somebody else's agenda? You know, there may be, and the agendas may come not necessarily from state actors. It may not come from the United States as a government. But the agendas, there are also strong private interests. You know, the evangelical right wing in the United States, shopping all kinds of things around the world, right? You know, so some of these things, we are fighting other people's culture wars. It's not really our fight. You know, these kinds of things did not, all of a sudden, boom, Ghana is talking about these things, right? But so the agendas are not always, you know, coming from state actors. We know that. They come from very organized, strong, organized, if sometimes fringe minority interests. They could be corporates, they could be religious, they could be other things. But, you know, basically you have to just ask yourself, what is it that I'm delivering to my people? Is this really what the people want, what they need? Or is it a diversion in an election year where, you know, the economy has crashed essentially? Is this what we are selling the people? Mm. You know, so even when you talk about sovereignty, and I think it goes back to your point, whose sovereignty? In Ghana, whose sovereignty? The regime in government, the political class, the establishment, the people as a whole? You know, these are not just monolithic, you know, even the concept of sovereignty, you know, like of national interest, you know, they're just not easy to define monolithically. There are different competing interests within the polity, and one or the other would want to elevate theirs to the level of the national to displace everyone else. So it's a very complex question, I think, as all of my peers here have said, but it's also a very important conversation that we must have.
Doc, perhaps you indulge us with a bit of economics. Let's do a bit of cost and benefit analysis, right? And maybe we can go around. We can start with the West. I mean, I keep referring to them as the devil, you know. Forgive me for the terminology, but we know them. We've come a long way with them. Let's do cost and benefit. When we deal with the West, what are the pros and what are the risks? Let's go round the table, if you will, starting with the West.
Right, Kojo, I believe that, like you said, the devil you know, I think that we are quite used to the mode of operation of the West. But I must say that in our experience with the West, you realize that, for instance, when you take the persistent IMF intervention in our economy, it's more like a four-year cycle. And every time the policy, the program will come with policy prescriptions, we will do a lot of work on the macroeconomic issues, attain the short-run goals, stabilize the economy. But the hard issues of working on the structure of the economy, working on institutional changes to make sure that we facilitate business and make sure that productivity, production flourishes in the economy, you don't tend to find that. And so you see that we attain short-term gains, stabilize, get all the macroeconomic indicators on track, and then the slightest shock, everything comes crumbling down. And so the issue really is that going forward, I think that we should focus more on the addressing the structural challenges that keeps us where we are consistently. And so, for example, and that is why I said that in our strategy towards the East, when you look at, for instance, our trade, trade between Ghana and China, it is basically export of raw materials, import of manufactured goods. It's been the same with the West. When you look at, for example, there have been trade agreements with the US, for example, like the AGOA. There have been agreements like the EPA, for example, with Europe. And you find that consistently, we still do the same thing. We are dependent on primary commodity exports. And so for that matter, if we don't do anything to transform and add a bit of value to the primary commodities we send out there, no matter which block or whatever we deal with, the outcome will not be different. The outcome will not be different in the sense that if, for example, the resources China is offering is quite attractive, it doesn't come with a lot of conditionalities. Yet, in dealing with them, we are still exporting primary commodities and we are importing manufactured goods. It is evident that in the long run, primary commodities, the prices of primary commodities relative to manufactured goods falls over time. So you certainly will lose competitiveness. You cannot compete. Your trade balance will always be in a deficit and you always find yourself in a fit, regardless of whichever block or country you are dealing with. And so for me, I think that the strategy, like we have all agreed, is to be, what do we want? And at this point, I think the emphasis is on building structures so that when the economy comes back on track, we grow in a resilient way. We grow in a way where we are adding value to a lot of our primary commodity exports, for which reason we can command a lot of value out there, and we will not be that vulnerable to the slightest external shocks that we observe.
If you just joined us, of course, this is our national dialogue. We're asking the question, should Ghana look east or west? We're making it an election discussion, and our guests, Professor Priscilla Chumisi, Dr. Priscilla Chumisi Bafo, who you just heard from. We also have Professor H. Kwesi Prempeh of CDD. We have Dr. Yao Graham of Third World Network Africa. And we're joined by Zoom by Yao Nsako. We're live on Joy 99.7 FM as well as here on Joy News. And of course, you can catch us on X Space Conversation and on Facebook Live and YouTube as well. Use the hashtag East v West or East or West. You can also use the hashtag Joy Dialogues. Prof, just before I move on to Dr. Graham, I've noticed something. Almost everyone on the panel has spoken quite extensively about the West, and when we come to the East, we've heard a lot about China. Everybody's avoiding Russia. Are they that scary? Don't they have anything to offer us economically? And is there a way of accessing it without blowing up our democracy entirely? What are your thoughts on Russia? I'll hear from Doc on the economic side of it before I come to Dr. Graham, if that's okay.
All right.
Yes. So, Doc Priscilla and then Doc Graham.
You don't have one.
I think the narrative around Russia's involvement in African economies is also the fact that they are coming without conditionalities, placing a lot of emphasis on sovereignty, a lot of emphasis on the right for you to do whatever you may. So for that matter, it looks, but in terms of Russia's engagement, you find that it is more towards security, military assistance, and to a large extent, I am not quite sure of the statistics with regards to trade with Russia. And so in that regard, and then issues of, they have not had much, quote-unquote, good publicity with regards to their involvement in economies in Africa. And so there's a lot more suspicion, and probably on the back of what is happening with Ukraine, everybody is quite, their involvement is quite unsettling, and also with reports of their involvement in mercenary actions in places of unrest in Africa. It is a bit unsettling, but I must say that I am not a political scientist.
Dr. Graham, we're still doing pros and cons, but perhaps you'll start us off with Russia, and then we can go through China and the West.
Yeah, I mean, I want to return to, I'll say something about Russia, but I just want to be a bit contrary at this point.
Okay.
That, I mean, the way the conversation has gone, I mean, it's pointing to the fact that to get value out of this conversation, we should escape the straitjacket of the East and West. Escape the straitjacket of framing the problematic in terms of the two powers who are in contest with the United States or in contest with NATO. Because it's important, not that they are not important for us, but once you identify those two countries, for example, currently, the UAE is putting more money into Africa than China. But nobody is talking about the UAE. Just points to the fact the Gulf countries are very influential in the problem in Sudan, which is a strategic problem for this continent. They are present in Sudan, Somalia, Ethiopia, that whole zone there. You know, Arab conservative, reactionary, authoritarian money from authoritarian Arab regimes is shaping this continent. So I mean, when I saw the East or West, quite frankly, I saw it as a play on Nkrumah's famous statement. And being a journalist myself, I saw it as a nice headline. But once we leave the headline, we come to the substance.
That's right.
If we continue to frame the discussion in terms of, you know, how to get the public drawn in, I think we'll be shortchanging the public that we've drawn, you know, into the conversation. Now, I think the on Russia, again, just like China, there's too much of a discussion about Russia, which has been framed by its geopolitical contest with the West. Okay? And this is a geopolitical contest which has suddenly become a problem. Because when the drunkard Yeltsin was in charge of Russia, and Russia was in the pocket of the United States, Russia was not a problem. When Putin came to power, relations were very good. Okay, Germany bases their strategy for energy around relations with Russia. So the Nord 1 and 2 pipelines were built, and all of Europe was getting Russian gas. It was very good for them. Then the tensions about the post-Soviet political and security settlement became more and more contentious. When it broke down over Ukraine and Russia invaded, suddenly the thing changed. Then we began to hear a different language. So I'm saying it's important to discuss Russia outside the evolution that suddenly Russia is in conflict with the West. When yesterday, Russia gave all of them cheap gas. Even now, people are importing a lot of things from Russia because they can't get it from anywhere else. So for me, in all these instances, it's important to step outside. Whatever we think about the war in Ukraine or Putin, I wouldn't like to live under him, okay? Whatever we think about him, it's important to frame this issue as from a Ghanaian and African perspective. That is the sense in which I understand Krumah's aphorisms. We are looking neither east nor west, not as a straitjacket, but as a representation, you know, how we should see, you know, our autonomy. Now, Russia, I mean, it's a country which offers various things beyond a Wagner, you know, a troops. Many countries around the world are buying their nuclear reactors from Russia. This is something they export. I mean, I'm not a fan of nuclear energy, but it may interest you to know that our energy transition plan projects 70% sourcing of renewable energy from nuclear in Ghana by 2040 or thereabouts. So if the government has announced, told the world that Ghana is going to be predominantly 70% nuclear as part of our energy transition in about 25 or so years, Russia becomes a relevant factor to think about. And energy transition is a major issue that we need to take hard-headed decisions on. Russia supplies nuclear fuels to all countries, including reactors in the United States. Okay, so when we deconstruct the thing away from geopolitics and begin to look, you know, at Russia. Russia has a lot of dependence on mineral export and mineral processing, chemical industry, and so on. Are there things we could learn from them? Are there things we can do with them? I think we should pose the thing in its complexity. Do we want to have a military pact with Russia? I mean, this government doesn't seem to have any difficulty having a military pact with the United States. I saw a very arrogant United States ambassador recently explaining away the presence of American troops. So, $20 million is a good sum of money to give to your military in exchange for us being here. And the business about, you know, Ghanaian kind of officials and institutions not being allowed access to where we are. I mean, it's similar to if I came to your house and you gave me a bedroom. Surely you knock before you enter the bedroom. I mean, this is not considered a problem. But we are worried about the people whose troops are not here. I dare say that part of that problem is that we have become used to being dominated by the West. The familiarity with the West is not only because they've been around for a long time, but the dominance is hegemonic in the sense that it's internalized by us.
It's like Stockholm syndrome.
So that's why the unfamiliarity with Chinese, small-scale Chinese miners are getting more grief than Newmont is getting, okay? Newmont entered this country on terms which are almost unconstitutional. 30-year stability clause and so on and so on. Nobody talks. What I'm trying to say is that dominance and the thing about sovereignty that Kwesi spoke about, there are so many levels at which we've given away our sovereignty and we celebrate it, okay? And if you accept his point about the condition of our ordinary people as a primary concern, the areas where we're giving away our sovereignty are the ones which are impeding our ability to improve people's conditions. So we should talk about the EPA. We talked about the trade agreements, which mean that domestic producers are under pressure. When we talk about the Chinese not having conditionalities, the terms that we grant them for exploiting the minerals. Conditionality comes in many forms, you know. I will not interfere in your politics so long as you allow me to dig as much minerals as I want for as long. So I think we need to, so the Russian thing, to come back to it. I mean, Russia has been framed in a particular way. It's an authoritarian regime, like Saudi Arabia, which is very close to the United States. But Saudi Arabia is in the pocket of the United States, not a threat to it, okay? Now, there are things about Russia and other authoritarian countries that we should learn from negatively, okay? So that certain forms of entanglement with them could be negative for us. So whilst we talk about the economic thing also, I mean, we should also ask, who do we want to do business? It's not a kind of a unconditional business. There are some people who say, listen, this regime is so ugly that we don't want to be seen with them because of the values that we have as a country. We have a constitution which sets out a certain vision of society. Okay, that should also have a bearing in terms of where we draw the line in terms of certain relations. Sweden was a pacifist country for a very long time. And it was a point of national pride. They identified with it. Ghana, in spite of all that has happened over time, we still are respected as a pillar of the African community. Now, these things are important. So some of them, there may be pressure put on them by some of the relations that you may want to get into and so on. So these are important. But back to Russia, I think if we look at Russia beyond the security problem in West Africa, where NATO troops are being kicked out of the Sahelian countries, and ask, what is even the West African interest in security? It goes back to my earlier point. I mean, I don't know that we are even managing the security problem in the region very well. With the disintegration that ECOWAS is facing, it makes a regional security conversation more difficult. So some sophistication may be required. It is complicated by bringing, you know, Russian troops. The sovereign decision they've taken is done. Now it's kind of brought the French out, Russians in, NATO out, Russians in. It brings a certain kind of geopolitical competition into the region, which complicates the conversation. But there's more to it than that.
Yeah. I mean, I think we should also contextualize the fact that Russia is already in Africa. We're not now considering whether or not to do business with Russia. They're already here. And the effect that they are already having is visible. So you talked about how the Sahelian countries,
one country.
One Sahelian country seems to obviously be